And we're live with Butch Patrick. Finally, Butch, thank you so much for being so understanding when I actually got COVID for the first time. Did you ever get it?
Yeah, I had it over Christmas last year.
So you got it too. And you held out for a long time also. Did it hit you bad? What, 'cause you weren't
No.
afraid of it when I talked to you last.
No, I knew it was like I didn't feel life threatening, and I went on the road and stuff. But it put me down for a few days, no doubt, like
Just a few
mentally.
days? Well, that's not so bad.
No, it wasn't bad at all.
A few days isn't bad. And no lasting stuff?
No, it's really funny. I always thought that I had a really strong immune system because I'm always out shaking hands and, sort of rubbing kids with runny noses and stuff are always in front of me and breathing on me and
Right.
getting on airplanes and driving around the country. So I think that I just have a strong immune system, but I was never really concerned about it. No.
Do you know how you got it?
No. No.
Okay. Well, good for you. I was down for a month.
Yeah,
A
I know
month.
people were. I know people that hit very, very hard, no doubt.
And it was crazy. And I fought. I didn't get it for what? It was 4 years. And then all of a sudden, boom! Yeah, you think you can? You think you're tough, you see?
Oh man, I remember early on when I had to go. I only did one piece of Hollywood work during it, and I had to do a Rob Zombie. I did too. I did an interview with CNN, and then I did Rob Zombie's voiceover work. But what got me was how crazy. There would be three people that were actually needed there, and then there'd be six people doing wipe downs. Yeah.
Right.
I told my sister, I said, the business will never be the same unless they get this behind them because there's no way they can make this work because it's just, you go at a snail's pace anyway in Hollywood, and then you add this to it, it becomes like, stop action.
Okay, so that was my next question. Are things back to normal, do you think, or is life forever changed?
It's forever changed. The thing that bothers me the most about it is the short attention span, the short memory span that people just seem to have forgotten about it, and that kind of scares me a little bit because they moved on. And I mean, I'm glad that they're not going after people and doing this and doing that the way it was. But a lot of people, it was pretty scary how many businesses got shut down and how many people lost their savings. I mean, it was, I mean, there are people, I mean, obviously people died. It was bad for just, mental health. But aside from that, if you didn't, wind up financially ruined, you probably had knew somebody that died.
Yeah, I think a lot of us did. Did it impact your bit? It must have. It impacted everybody's business. Did it impact you in your business?
Well, my business is pretty much going on the road and working with promoters and cities and chambers of commerce. So me, what I did, I right when it happened, I went to California. I had left my trailer in Atlanta. I left my truck in North Carolina, and I flew to California to see my sister. And that's when they did the lockdown. I was there for about 2 days, and that's when everything got locked down. And it was very weird because I would look at the airport. There were no planes in the sky. There was no people on the freeways. It was crazy. It was like a movie. It was very much like aliens had come or the rapture had come or whatever. There was nobody around, and the thing was, is during that time, I basically figured, well, I got to go back and get my stuff. I just can't leave my stuff in people's driveways and on their property. So about 3 months into it, I made a choice that I was going to go get my stuff, and a guy called me from Wisconsin, and he says, I'm having an outdoor car event. Social distancing and all that stuff, and he invited me to it, and I said, okay, I'm gonna pick my stuff up, I'm gonna drive up there, and we're gonna see how it goes. And from Wisconsin, I then came down through the Midwest, and then I kind of zigzagged through, and I kept finding things to do, mostly outdoor events, and mostly,
That was just a few months into COVID.
yeah,
There were events going on.
yeah. I came out in January.
Wow.
First event was in May. And then I just kept staying, and then I would fly, and there would be nobody in the airport. It was really weird. I mean, nobody in the airport, and obviously the masks thing, and there was a lot of. I mean, we were all there. We remember what it was like. It was challenging. It really was challenging. But like I say, I survived it, and I actually, I was lucky to participate in what I do. A lot of that is car guys, and they're kind of a tough breed anyway. And as long as they As long as they could do it outside and get the government's approval or the state's approval and get a permit, they did it. and people showed up, and it was interesting to see as it evolved. When I finally did a parade on the second year, I think in Detroit, the kids that had been locked up, I mean, when they came out in droves. I mean, when they finally had a chance to get out of the house, oh my gosh. I mean, I'm glad I was alive, I mean, to see it and to kind of witness it, but at the same time, I certainly hope it never happens again.
Yeah. And so, how about personally, is your life like my life is so different? I do not do it. I don't do as much out of the house. I used to be out all the time. I used to go hear live music a few days a week and go to movies all the time and just do a lot of stuff. And I don't do a lot of stuff anymore. Do you do as much stuff as you used to do before?
I did 75 appearances last year and about 50 the year before that. So
Wow.
what I do, and you know, obviously there's only 52 weeks in a year. What I do is when I'm on the weekends doing something, as I'm driving my truck and my trailer and my cars to the next event, I find something in the path. I'll Google some oddity stores or tattoo parlors or drive-in movie theaters, something that I've done in the past, and I will contact somebody in that route and let them know that I'm coming by, and if they would like to do a promotion together. If you put me up in a hotel for the night, you know, there'll be no travel costs, and we can get into your email, and we can get a bunch of people to show up at your business. So that is the trick, is the weekends are reasonably easy to book, but it's those 5 days in the middle that you're sort of sitting around twiddling your thumbs. And I figured out a way to get a Tuesday or Wednesday, Thursday gig in transit, and that's where the other 25 appearances popped up.
And are the numbers back to what they were pre-COVID, pretty much?
Pretty much, yeah.
Pretty
Yeah.
much.
Yeah, but I mean, like I say, my whole thing has always been, you know, not to get a political thing going on, but I've always kind of, although I do a lot of stuff in Illinois, which is a blue state, but I've kind of always gravitated and done stuff in the South and in red states anyway. And they seem to be a little more open, and they were at least during the crunch of it. There's a little more activity in the red states, but now it's I very, very rarely do I have any issues with it whatsoever. And it's a big country, and I luckily for me, I found you know, I found my little niche and weathered it and got through it.
Do you find, Butch, that when you run into people, are you ever surprised by the people that are excited to meet you? Like, does it ever blow your mind? Like, I know everybody's excited to meet you, and we all grew up with you, but like, have there been any celebrities that have like taken you by surprise because they're fans of yours?
Yes, absolutely. I'm very, very lucky in that respect. Surprisingly, a lot of musicians, a lot of rock stars. Which is fun. I've been lucky enough recently with well, obviously Rob Zombie, who did the Munsters movie. But I know a lot of rock stars, and this particular year I have a friend with Trans-Siberian Orchestra, Alice Cooper, I consider to be a friend, John Five, Lita Ford, you know, I mean, just a lot of people I've met over the years, and they seem to be Munster fans. And one of the things that keeps me going, and because people say, "Don't you ever get tired of it?" I go, you know, it's really tough not to like doing it, because you're in the middle of a positive exchange of energy with people. They come to the table, and I'm not talking about celebrities. I'm talking about the people who are coming up to meet you. They've watched you on TV. They're fans. You were a big part of their growing up, with whether it be watching it with a favorite uncle who's no longer with us, or grandpa. But when you have this little interaction of people at the table, and it's always a smile, and it's always a good thing, it kind of makes your day. And to know that the smallest little thing on your side of the coin to give them, you know, ask them about their lives, talk to them on their, you know, whatever area, whatever city I'm in, try to find some common ground to discuss their life. They walk away happy. And my biggest challenge is always, I tell people that hire me, I said, you know, the one thing we never want to do is I never want to see anybody turn around and walk away from the table angry or mad or sad or disappointed. So on that note, it's so easy to keep it positive. It's just I'm very blessed.
And everybody who meets you loves you. I mean, you have such a great vibe out there. Everybody gets so excited when they know you're going to be around and there's an opportunity to interact with you.
It's funny with that boob tube. I mean, being on a little show, I mean, I work from 60 to 74, but the Munsters is unique. It's special. Definitely one of a kind. You know, people,
Absolutely.
a believable family unit. It was a well-produced, well-written show, and it's endured very well. But It's still funny how the being on television to a lot of people is still magical. I mean, they just really, really treat you special and in a good way. And it's just I was a kid, I knew what it was like to not, look outside the 19-inch screen and you'd see the grip over there with a cup of coffee. And you'd see the guy up in the catwalks reading the paper, but the people watching the show, it's a magical experience for them. And I was a big fan of TV. I'm a fan. I love, the old black and white episodes and the shows. And so I'm glad to have been part of the whole process.
And it was magical. And to this day, I don't think there's ever been anything quite like it because it mixed humor with horror, although it wasn't horror at all. It looked like horror, but it wasn't at all. And that humor was so well written, so well executed.
Well,
Fred Wynn, one of the greatest comic
yes,
actors.
I had a gentleman. I was at a show, and oh God, I forgot it. Oh, what's this? Robert Wool, who played Arliss.
Robert's a really good friend of mine. I love Robert.
We're in the green room at a big show, and I see him, and I'm a big fan of his. And before I could say hi to him, he goes to me. He goes, "Butch, I got a quick question for you." He goes, "Were you aware of the immense talent that you were working with with Mr. Fred Gwynne and Al Lewis?" And I said, not as much as I do now, but as a kid, yeah, they treated me well and we were equal big." He goes, "Those guys were comic geniuses." And
Absolutely.
but that's coming from someone who is very knowledgeable, and he's a great guy. But that's the kind of thing, is one of the reasons I think the show did so well is, number one, it was produced by the Leave It to Beaver people. Leave It to Beaver was a groundbreaking show in its own right, with the scripts being written from a kid's point of view. Where
Right.
the show is all about the kids and the parents, but the kids are the stars and the parents were second. And they kind of took that and ran with the Universal Monsters, which Universal was famous for. And then they took that quality and the film look, so they had the genre down where the monsters looked like a 1931 Frankenstein movie, but it had Leave It to Beaver humor and scripts, except the childlike Beaver was now Herman Munster. So
Right.
they mushed it all together in this very, on paper, it probably looked like, I don't think so, but for some reason the characters clicked and the family unit was believable. And then if you add one more layer onto it, in the mid-60s, it actually had very subtle overtones of racial stuff, of like, people didn't want to live next door to the Munsters. People and these people, Colley and Mosher also produced Amos and Andy in the 50s. So
Wow.
it was a very soft-handed integration type of thing going on, social commentary going on under the guise of a comedic monster mishmash.
Was it a hard sell because it was in black? I wonder if it was a hard sell because it was in black and white, because that was like the time of everything being in color, right?
No, actually, we
Was
were
it
the
before color?
before color. Yeah.
It was before color.
Yeah, we were 64 and 65, into a little bit of 66. Batman came out in color. Walt Disney's World of Color came out in color. The transition was going to be, if we were going to do a third season, the cost factor, who was going to absorb it, whether it would be CBS or the producers, and would they, the ratings had dropped. Would they move us to another night to get away from Batman? In my opinion, I think Fred and Al were New Yorkers who were ready to go home. I think it had run its course. The scripts were getting a little thin. We wound up doing a movie in color, Munster Go Home,
Right.
which was a strategic business move, because now they could release the movie worldwide and people in other countries would know what the Munsters were, and then they could then be fed syndication.
Right. And did that work out that way?
Yeah, the Munsters also was a very profitable, and still is a very profitable merchandising juggernaut. Toys, licenses, to this day, the toys come out constantly. You'll hear the Munsters theme with Walmart commercials at Halloween. You'll see McDonald's. It's been a very good cash cow for Universal. That's why it took Rob Zombie 20 years to make his movie, because they're so protective of it. They just don't hand it to anybody.
Do you still benefit from it?
Well, I benefit from the fact that I get movie. The movie is a different contract than the series. Once in a while, I'll get a check from European cable houses or stuff, and nothing substantial. But I benefit from it. because it allows me to do a lot of stuff because it's so well received and it's evergreen and it's family friendly and it's popular.
Right. It's set you on the path for everything else that you can possibly do.
It's been really good to me. And I mean, I did a lot of fun stuff, but that's the, you know, if you got to be remembered for something, I could think of a lot worse things. And as you know, we were chatting earlier, it almost didn't even come my way. It was one of those, it was kind of meant to be because it certainly wasn't a typical, you know, getting the part was so far out of the normal. And you want me to explain how it happened?
Yeah, so let's I was just going to say, so let's talk about it.
Well, I had done it the year of the Real McCoys, and right when the last year of the Real McCoys is over, I went with my grandmother to live in Illinois because my mother and my family, she had married a baseball player with the Angels, and he got traded to the Washington Senators. So the whole family unit went to the East Coast, and I went to Illinois with my grandmother, lived in this little town that I liked. And what happened was is they had cast the show already.
But
They asked me.
you had been acting for how old were you at this point, Butch?
I'm almost 11, and I started when I was 7.
Okay, and the initial was also by chance, correct? The way you got into showbiz initially.
Right. What happened was Mary Grady, who became one of the premier agencies in Hollywood for children only, she was like the first child only agency, and her son Don Grady played Robbie on My Three Sons, and then
Right.
Lon's daughter went on to Eight Is Enough and other things. But at this time, when I met her, she had just opened the doors of her studio, and I think the only client she really had was her son. And they were looking at my little sister for some print modeling, and I went along for the ride that day because I guess, you know, whatever reason, I was in the car with my mom and my sister. Amos Carr, who at that time was the go-to child photographer on Hollywood Boulevard. Every kid at, you know, in Hollywood had their headshots done by Amos Carr. And when they were done with her, he looked over at me and he goes, "Do you mind if I take a couple pictures of your son?" My mom goes, "Oh, no, not at all." So he put this goofy hat on me and I did a silly pose and he put it in the window of his studio. And about a month later, a producer and a director from 20th were walking by and they were still trying to cast the youngest son of Eddie Albert and Jane Wyatt for this little B movie called The Two Little Bears. Brenda Lee was 15 years old. She played my older sister. Soupy Sales played the comic relief cop. Nancy Culp played my school teacher,
Oh
Miss.
my God.
So it was this great little B movie, and I went up for this interview, and they wound up hiring me. So during that 6 weeks, I got some experience, picked up a couple cornflakes commercials, a Frosted Flake commercial by the time the movie was over. And then I went over and did the first few episodes of General Hospital that ever, the first time I was ever on the air. And that led to a few other guest starring roles. And then the fast forward to Real McCoys, and I left town. And then the Mumpsters.
So wait, so you lucked into all of this stuff. Was it something you wanted? Were you hungry for it?
No, I was hungry to make money to buy a race car when I was 18 years old. I had a plan at 7 years old that this money would come in handy and I wouldn't be going back to public school. Not that I hated public school, but I was comfortable around adults and I had a good memory and I
So you
basically.
were getting tutored on sets? Is that what?
Yeah, 3 hours a day. It's always been pretty much the same. You have to get at least 20 minutes in per sit down, or it doesn't count. So they get 20 minutes. Sometimes they'll give you an hour, but you have to get 3 hours a day done. And we did that. And if you're good at it in one-on-one in 3 hours a day, you can actually have a probably a better education than sitting in a classroom if you're a quick study and you catch it. So I think I got a good education. I went back and forth between public school
I was going
and.
to say, did you do that the whole, you didn't do that the whole, most
No,
of the time?
the only time I wound up in the professional schools we spoke about the Cowsills was Hollywood Professional. I enrolled there for my junior and senior years because the public school system wouldn't allow me to go leave I left the country for 3 months to do a movie, and they wouldn't let me stay in the same grade. So I either had to figure something out, and that was Hollywood Professional School that catered to professional children's needs in the business. So I went out of the country for 3 months, came back. When I enrolled in the school, the Cowsills were going at that time. Barry was in my grade. We raised hell and caused all kinds of. We had so much fun. Susan was there, John was there, and Paul was there. He was a senior, and anyway, it was a really wonderful experience. So the Munsters comes about, and what they do is they ask Bill Mumy, who was probably the hardest working kid in Hollywood at the time, and
Right.
he. For whatever reason, I believe that, you know, what it just didn't fit into his plan at the time. So they turned it down. And then they wound up making a pilot with a kid named Happy Derman, Nate Happy Derman.
Oh, there was a pilot without you.
In color. And then the net, and
In color.
without Yvonne DiCarlo, they had another woman named Joan Marshall, who looked very much like Morticia Adams, long black hair, slight, like ironed hair. So black outfit, and the network saw the pilot and they said, "We want the pilot, but we want to change the kid and we want to change the wife." And they brought in Yvonne DiCarlo for the star power. Fred and Al thought it was a bad decision, that Yvonne proved them wrong. She did a wonderful job and she did comedy
Why
great.
did they think it was a bad decision?
They thought that she would be a prima donna and hard to work with.
Oh.
She was a movie star, and movie stars weren't doing TV at that time. She was one of the first.
Right.
So they said yes to the show, but we want to get another kid. And Mary Grady caught wind of it and reached out to them and said, "I've got the perfect kid for you." And she goes, "We've looked at every kid in Hollywood." She goes, "There's where you're wrong. He's not in Hollywood. He's in Geneseo, Illinois. And if you buy him a plane ticket, he can be here tomorrow." So my uncle picked me up at the airport, drove me to CBS Studio Center. I tested with Yvonne DiCarlo. They told me make arrangements to report to work 3 days later. So now I'm out in the West Coast with no mom, no dad, no stepdad, and no siblings, but I gotta figure out a way to get to work every day. So we hired a woman, a friend of the family, and I stayed at my uncle's house, lived with my uncle, and I would fly home to DC once a month to visit my family.
How was that life for you?
Was just an extension of the studio life. It was, like I say, it was, I never really knew anything different. So for me, it was okay.
Did you get along with your uncle? Was
Oh
he
yeah,
really?
oh, my uncle Woody was, he was like, yeah, the best. I mean, yes, got along great. Loved Uncle Woody,
Did you
and it
have
took.
too much freedom because you were with Uncle Woody and not with Mom and?
No, because I was working. I was going to work. I was up at 6, eating breakfast, but getting picked up at 6:30 to get to the studio by 7:30. We lived quite a ways away, so I was busy, and I liked Woody, and I liked Aunt Darlene, and they had kids, my cousin Mike and Mark and Doug, and it was they were. We were my mom and my uncle Woody were the closest siblings in the family, so they always were close, and their family was always with our family, and it wasn't like I wasn't at his house anyway.
Right.
I practically lived over there. We just had to make arrangements where was I going to sleep, and we just put two beds in Mike's room, I think.
And so, how quickly did life change for you? I would imagine once the Munsters hit the airwaves.
The only thing that was bad about the whole situation for me was when I left the Munsters, I was in the 7th grade. I was pretty small for my size, for my age, and I went back into the public school system to a junior high school in Gardena where I was living with 3,500 students. Big school, big school. And kids will be kids, so when I stepped back on the campus, the problem was when I would go to nutrition or something, everybody wanted to say something, look at you, gawk at you, make fun of you, it's typical stuff what kids do. And
Right.
the vice principal, Mr. Brenner, kept throwing me out of school because kids would go back to class during nutrition. There would be like a couple 300 kids surrounding me, and he just said, "You're the problem. We're getting rid of you. They'll go back to class." So I would, pretty get thrown out of school. And the third time it happened, it was like, "Mom, this, what are the options?" And she says, "Well, we can put you in a private school." I said, "I don't want to go to a private school." She goes, "Well, then you just got to go back to school and weather it, And that's pretty much what I did. And it wore down after a few weeks. Kids, they got out of their system. But to this day, people still knock on, my mom still owns the same house, still knock on the door. "Does any Munster live here?" The palm trees that are 7 feet tall when we moved in there are now like 70 feet tall and like black. But it's the same old house that we moved into when I was in the 4th grade.
Wow. Okay, so now you have success, and are you auditioning all the time? What is your life like outside of school? Are you're still Butch Patrick, the actor, so are you pursuing that?
Yes, I did. After the Munsters, I was never a actor. I was just someone who could do the job, and I was never really a calling for me. I knew that I was going to quit when I was 18 because of the child labor laws, and I had a plan. All I wanted to do was party. It was Woodstock. It was the 60s, and I was kind of a wild child, and a few of us were, but I lived outside of Hollywood. I didn't hang out with the Hollywood crew. I wanted to be accepted by my peers. So yeah, I kept working. did a lot of Disney work, did 9 episodes of My Three Sons, did a lot of work in what was a 7 to 19, 12 years from 1960 to 72. Did some interesting stuff. I did some of the things I did. I worked with Chuck Jones on a really good movie, his only feature film, The Phantom Tollbooth. I did the Monkees Christmas episode when I was like 14 years old, which was like the Monkees were bigger than the Beatles at that time.
Okay, so let's stop a minute here because we've talked about this before, but we have to talk about it again because I was friends with Mike and I love Mickey and have met Peter. And so for you as a teenage boy, were you a Monkees fan?
Yeah, absolutely.
So was this like a big deal to get the Monkey Show or not so
Yeah, it was
much?
huge. I never ever cared about whether I got a part or not. I would go up, I would do my bit, I'd come home, whether I got it, I got it. I didn't. This was the only time that I called Mary Grady up and asked her, can you please call them up and let me know what's going on? Because I really, really, really want this. And I got the part. And the neat part about it was, is well, number one, I got to tell all my friends at school about it, which I never did. And number two, the part for the Christmas episode, not only was it a great episode because it was the Christmas episode, which I wasn't aware of until I saw it, but I was in almost every scene with the guys. So I really worked a lot with them as an equal, as opposed to just sort of being a kid off to the side that just sort of stands there and eats an ice cream cone, because the episode was about me finding the spirit of Christmas and them being my inspiration to find it and being the problem. They were the kids and I was the adult child. So anyway, I got to work as an equal with them, and it was really cool. And then when I saw the episode, I was blown away, because not only did the thing that I got is show their talent with singing Ryu-Chiu a cappella, but when they broke the fourth wall down and they said, they brought everybody in front of the camera and said, this is so and so, here's our Monkey Girls. That is an exact representation of what a fun set it was. It was just fun. They had a good time. They were on top of the world. Everybody loved being there. It was wacky. It was zany. It was all kinds of adjectives. But I'm glad they showed that particular breakdown of all the guys coming out, because that's the type of people they were.
What on the, during the taping, were they improvising or were they sticking to the script?
They improvised a little bit, but mostly they stuck to the script. I mean, there's one scene in there in the toy in the department store where all the toys are being in, and Mickey, I look at it, he hands me a styrofoam cup that he was drinking water out of as a gift. It's like he hands it to me, and I take it. I look up at him with this very quizzical look, like, "Why are you handing me this?" But he just was like, "Hey, take this, kid." You know, like, and I, you know, and Peter was my favorite at the time because I was a hippie and he was a hippie. I was a fan of Davey because of the Artful Dodger, and you know him being as you know a stage
I
actor.
saw him as the Artful Dodger.
I knew him. I knew Mickey from Circus Boy. Mike, not
Mm-hmm.
so much. Mike was, you know, he was kind of like he was in the show. He was kind of quiet and reserved, and but what a talent, you know, huge talent. And then the more as I got older, the more I appreciated all of the things that he was doing. Very, very ahead of his time, cutting edge stuff. You know, Video Ranch and stuff, and Elephant Parks. Amazing stuff.
So you must have had a lot of cachet going back to school after being in the Monkees.
Oh yeah, that was good. That was one of the good ones. And then the Disney stuff was good too. It was good quality work. Disney was the gold standard if you were a kid actor, and if you wound up going over to Disney. I was only there for like I did one two features and two World of Color two-parters one summer. I wasn't there that long, but I was very proud of the work that we did. But you know, I get pretty busy. But my mom would come to try to get me to work more. I mean, she never forced me to work, but she would, after school, if there was an interview, she would drive the car as I was walking home and lean over and, "Hey, we got an interview at Paramount," and I'd either say yes or no. And I'd say about two-thirds of the time I said no. You know,
Really?
it wasn't that important to me. I was more into hanging out with my friends and riding my Stingray and riding my mini bike. But and
And
that was just
do you have
that
any
was
regrets on that score?
no. The
Good.
only regret, and I very rarely do this because you can't fix your regrets. The only thing is,
Right.
I wish that I had altered my thought process when I was older and got my money out of the bank. But I thought I was going to Vietnam. I was in the last year of the lottery. I had a low number. I went up to the induction center, and I was convinced, me and my friend were convinced we were going to Vietnam and we were going to die. So what money I had is I spent. You know, I went out and blew it because I never thought I was coming back. Had a great time. You know, everybody should have, who was it that said everybody should have two fortunes? Oh, Jackie Gleason said everybody should have two fortunes, one to blow and then, you know, another one to live on. And so you got to have one to just blow it out. Well, I didn't have a fortune, but I had a reasonable amount of money. It was certain, by no means a fortune, but I was a 19-year-old kid with some good toys. And what happened was I never really set myself up to do anything but acting. So what I should have done is I should have figured out a career in the industry that in a not directing, you know, everybody says, did you want to direct? Hell no, that's more work than acting. I'm looking for something of a niche that's fun. I should have been a location scout. That's what I should have done.
Wow.
I like travel. I understand a script. I like architecture. I can read a script. I know what they're looking for. And I have the gift of gab to go in and talk to politicians and mayors and make sure that it's feasible to do what Hollywood requires. It will allow me to do that. It's a niche, a very niche job, but I would have been good at that.
Interesting. Giselle is here, by the way. Say hi to your girlfriend.
Hi, Giselle.
And tell us the story. How did you guys meet? You met during during the pandemic. How did you guys meet?
Well, yeah, that's kind of the tail end. She lives in New Jersey. My car club that I'm a member of, Dead Man's Curve, is the world's greatest car club. Super guys, a small club. I think we have about 16 members now. They hired me to come to their car show one day, and we became friends. And I still think they need a TV show, but that's another story. And I was out at Wednesday night. There's a place called the Blue Arrow Farm. A gentleman named Don Arroyo, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing his name, but he has an animal sanctuary out there, and they do live music, and they got a bunch of neat stuff out there. So my club brother Danny, who puts on the music and the entertainment, asked me to come out and display my cars and be part of the crew, which I did. And then Giselle had a friend of hers who mentioned she likes to go to conventions and she likes to do cosplay and this and that. So her girlfriend told her, hey, Eddie Munster and Butch Patrick's going to be out at the farm. You ought to go out and say hi. So she almost didn't make it, but it was like 10 minutes away. She got up and came out and said hi. And then I'm sitting and doing my spiel. And one thing led to another. And I guess she got a shirt and a picture that I had forgotten. And then at the end of the night, I'm getting ready to, you know, close up my shop. And a guy says, hey, you know, I want to get a picture. I got to tell you what, you'll be the last person. If you get this picture, I'll take a photo over with the car and then we'll call it a day. And she goes, and I've been watching her throughout the day. You know, she's only 5 foot tall. So I had to keep because she was kept disappearing behind people. So she shows up. She goes, well, hey, I bought a shirt and a picture. I go, I'll tell you what I'll do. You wait around. We'll put the, you jump in the car. We'll go for a little joy ride before I put the car away. That's kind of how we met. So my Munster coach allowed us to spend a little time together, and then she came to the car club car show. One thing led to another, and then she came down to Myrtle Beach at Halloween, and we've been seeing each other ever since.
That's okay. So now tell us about this the way that you guys do your relationship, because it's a little unusual, but it works for you guys.
Yeah, she's a Jersey girl. She lives in Vernon, New Jersey, up at a ski slope. Great gorge, I believe it is. She's got a son, Andres, 20. He was 20 when I met her. He's 23 now. I am in Arkansas, a little town called Conway outside of Little Rock, which is my base of operations. And she recently retired a couple months ago, and now she was meeting me on the road, but she always had to fly home for work. So it was really difficult to get her on a Friday, get her out on a Sunday so she could be at work, you know, by Tuesday because she was off on Monday. So now that she's retired, our plan and what we're doing now is she just had 17 days on the road with me and just got home last week. So now we do about half and half, you know, half the time on the road, half the time she goes home. And then occasionally I go to the Northeast, which we will be doing in April. I'm doing two big shows, and one in Connecticut and one in New Jersey. But we do about a 50-50 split. Sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. And so far, so good.
So Tony's asking what brought you to Arkansas. We discussed it a little bit before the show, but why don't you tell everybody why you're in Arkansas?
Yeah, a few years ago when the Munsters pinball machine came out, I was touring with the Stearns Pinball Company to introduce this machine. This was their A-list gold standard machine. And when I would go to a big convention where all the pinball fanatics would go to, or, you know, they would surround me with like 13 Munsters pinball machines, and I'd have my cars on display in the middle. And a gentleman that lives here, that is my friend, Keller, has an arcade. He's a pinball collector himself, but he puts them on display for people to enjoy instead of just hoarding them himself. He's got several hundred machines, and he bought one, and he asked me to come to Arkansas to look at his arcade, come into town for there's a festival here called Toad Suck Days, believe it or not, and it's a big to do. Arkansas loves their festivals. Toad Suck Days, it's a big event.
Toad suck.
Toad Suck Days, like a toad drinking a drink. And the logo is like a big fat toad on a rock by the lake with a drink in his hand with a straw. Okay, so it's called Toad Suck Days. Signs on the side of the road and everything. So he invited me down. I came in, really liked the town because it's got a small town feel, even though it's got 75,000 people and it's a half an hour from Little Rock. It still has very much a feel of a small town. And I had been living in a small town in Macon with my grandma's old house that I bought, and I was bored to death. I love my grandma and I love saving the house, but I couldn't, it's one thing to be there when you're 12 years old on a Stingray bike, and it's another thing to be there when you're, almost 7 years old and there's just nothing going on. So I was happy to sell the house, hand it over to somebody else, and relocate. And I had a thing going up in Indianapolis that fell apart at the last minute, no fault of my own. It just, wasn't meant to be. And it happened to be the same weekend as Toad Suck Days. And I called Keller and I go, I don't know what I'm going to do. This whole thing fell apart. And I haven't done anything. I haven't booked anything for the summer because I thought I was going to be at this theme park. And he goes, well, it's Toad Suck weekend. Come on down here. My sister was with me. I said, hey, you want to go down to Arkansas and see some nice people and some nice folks? And I came down for the second trip and I looked around and I started seeing opportunity, and Keller and I talk some business and this and that, and here I am.
And you're ha and it's been a good choice for you.
It's been a great choice. It's a wonderful opportunity. A lot of nice people. It's a good base for me. I still do a lot of stuff in Nashville. I still do a lot of stuff in the South and Florida. I like the Southeast. It's good for me for what I do.
Okay, so tell us what you do. Tell us about your vehicles and the things that you do.
Well, when I was a kid, George Barris, who built the Munster Coach and the Dragula and the Bear, and the Batmobile and everything in Hollywood, was a dear friend of mine. And right around in the early 80s, I left the Munsters. I'm in the early 80s. I'm 28, 29 years old. I hadn't really acted for like 10 years, but what happened was MTV came on the air, and me and a friend of mine decided we wanted to make rock videos. That was going to be our calling, but we had never done one. So I wrote the lyrics to a Munsters theme called Whatever Happened to Eddie, and we produced and did a little video that we then took to New York, and unannounced we BS'd our way up the tower of MTV and got them to air this video on Super Bowl Sunday. And we didn't have a record, and we didn't have a record deal, and it was the first ever unsigned act video ever to be on MTV. And from that idea, they created a show called The Basement Tapes, because they thought, well, if these guys did, there's probably a lot of bands out there that have a video camera that don't have a record deal that are making their videos. Because the early days of MTV were wonderful, before it became corporate, before it became commercials, the earliest videos were the best, in my opinion, before they got overproduced. So
You know,
that's where
Mike
we're.
Nesmith is really responsible for the birth of MTV, actually,
Well,
because he
I've
started it all. Yeah, with
it's just
Elephant.
that. So what happened with that is, in 1982, I reconnected with Al Lewis, and Al Lewis and I was in New York and he was in LA, and he took the band Les Minus Me to the Palladium and introduced them on Halloween. I was doing my thing on the East Coast, and one thing led to another, and right about that time, conventions started to get traction. Personal appearance conventions, San Diego Comic-Cons, all of these. The one I'm doing right now next month is called Chiller. I think this is the 34th year. I did the first one. So when these conventions started happening, they started looking for celebrities, horror celebrities, regular mainstream celebrities, musical celebrities, wrestlers. So the Munsters fell into this opportunity where people were actually, funding you to come to a show and have the Munster Coach on display, like a car show, and they would pay you to be there, or pay for your cars to be on display. And I wound up winding up with a Munster Coach, not a George Barris car, but I wound up with a Munster Coach and a Dragula and my chopper. So now I do a combination of auto-related shows. I work with communities and businesses and mayor's offices to do festivals that they need a celebrity, or they need some parade cars for their annual whatever fest they have. and it's something that I enjoy doing. So I found a really good little niche market between my car club and my cars, and working with the communities to help them market and promote whatever endeavor they've got going on. That's
This
so
sounds like
awesome.
something
Well,
that
this is
requires you to be hands-on. Is this something that you do yourself, or do you have someone who works the schedule out for you?
I do most of it myself. I do have a
Sounds
couple of
like
agents.
it.
I do most of it myself. I do have several agents. I'm not exclusive with anybody, but I do most of it myself. I do the midweek stuff myself, but lately I've got a new agent that's working with Danny Coker from Counting Cars in Vegas, and he does car stuff, and he's got a good fit for me. But most of it has come down myself. But lately, I'm getting a little bit more help from the side.
And so I would imagine that wherever you go, people are just beside themselves to meet you. So do you find that it's mostly people my age, or do kids, because of reruns, have, is it also kids discovering you and all of that?
It's mostly, it starts with people our age. A gentleman, a good friend of mine with Daytona Dodge one time, Randy Dye, ex-NASCAR driver. A friend of mine introduced me to him, and I told him what I was up to. And he goes, "I gotta tell you," he goes, "when I talked to you," he goes, "I knew who you were." He goes, "but I didn't think, you'd had a big enough draw to warrant what you're asking." But he goes, "I changed my mind when I walked in my dealerships and I asked every person I ran into, and that was several hundred people." And he goes, "and everybody knew the Munsters." And he goes, "and on that note," he goes, "I felt comfortable bringing you in." And then what he gave me some advice early on, because he was my first car dealership, because I used to sell cars. My stepdad owned a car dealership. So I knew car dealerships were a source of revenue because they need help drawing attention to their property. They spend a lot of money on advertising, they spend a lot of money in print. So I knew that if you can show them how I can get 300 or 400 people to come to the showroom, I'm doing my job, and you're going to be very happy to have, worked this deal with me.
Right.
So what he told me, he gave me some very good advice. He goes, "Butch," he goes, "you got it." He goes, "a lot of people don't get it." He goes, "but you got it. And if you can get to a decision maker, you'll close the deal because you're good at what you do, and you have a brand, and people like it, and they'll come out." And with that note, I continue to do car dealerships, not as many as I used to, but I always knew that there would be business for me, if nothing else, if I just went on car dealerships only, because there's so many of them. But I don't really want to be, I don't want to be Cal Worthington. It's now people that don't know who Cal Worthington is, he was a huge car dealership promoter of extraordinary gifted man, but he used to own the late night commercials in Los Angeles.
So you've done some work though. I see on your IMDb that you've done some work in the last few years. So how does that come to you? If like, do you do home tapes? Do you not have to audition anymore? What do people just write parts for you? How does it go down now?
Well, it's interesting. The audition process is what really got me out of the business, because I just got tired of, I felt, how much work do you really have to do before somebody maybe mails you a script? I didn't expect the world to come to my door, but I was thinking, there's got to be some, when does this get a little better, as opposed to always doing the same stuff? Plus, I wasn't an actor. I was just a kid that could do the job. But to answer your question, luckily for me, the independent movie I industry is booming. I mean, indie movies are just, everybody's doing movies. Technology's there. Everybody wants to do them. And there's a lot of people making money doing $50,000, $100,000 little movies, a lot of them. And a lot of the people who are fans of the Munsters or fans of me are kind enough to reach out and say, "hey, I've got this. I don't have much of a budget. Got a little indie movie. Would love for you to be in it." And I say, if it's easy and the content's there, and it's not gross and, what weird, yeah, I'll try to accommodate you the best I can, because I feel it's an honor for them to think of me, number one. Number two, it's kind of giving back to the industry in a small way. And they're fun to do. And it's like riding a bike, and you never forget how to act.
But do you ever have aspirations to do a Netflix series or anything like that?
No, if it came my way, I certainly would consider it. I like what I would like to do. I've had three. It's really weird, because I've had three really good produced pilots over the last 6 years, One is about two guys collecting, the Toy Scout. Joel McGee's a friend of mine, and he just sold the world's biggest Disney collection. And he and I did a pilot about Toy Scouts with me and him going around the country with kind of like American Pickers, but mostly for toys. Great, great pilot. No interest. I did another one with Tom Devlin, who's a who has the movie. Tom Devlin's in Boulder City. He's got world famous Monster Museum, and him and he's great. He was on. He was on like for 12 weeks on Face Off with Mackenzie Westmore, and he and I did a pilot called Haunt Rescue about us going into people that have haunted houses that are in trouble, and we go in and show them what they're doing wrong, which I thought was a no-brainer. And then I had one with the ghost when I owned my grandma's haunted house about paranormal activity, property horrors, and none of them got picked up. I don't understand the business. Apparently, I certainly don't understand why people aren't picking stuff up. So if something else came along, I would love to be part of the creative ensemble at the table. And if I happen to be in, if they require me to be in the front of the camera, I would do it if it was a requirement, but I would be very happy to be behind the scenes, just part of the team.
Okay, now speaking of paranormal activities, do you believe in ghosts?
Well, my grandma's house, it has active ghosts, and I got my security cameras have ghosts on camera. Yes, absolutely. My
Like
sister,
what?
when I bought the house, she told me, by the way, the house is haunted. I go, no. And she goes, yeah. And she goes, Miss Ruby is the name of the ghost. And you're going to see this, you're going to see that. And the whole town knew this house was haunted. So when I moved into it, I put security cameras up. And here, you want to see a ghost real quick? I can show
Yeah,
you
I
what.
mean, have you personally had experience with?
No, I have
No.
not. My sister did. Other people have in the house. All I got is a security camera. Showing a entity going by. Here we are. I'll show you real quick. Okay, I don't know if you can see this or not. Let me see here. Can you see it? You'll see a little. Hold on. We're over here. Now watch the little guy go walking by the door after this guy goes by. No, it's not accurate.
It's hard to see because of the reflection.
Okay, hold on.
I thought I saw something at the very
Okay.
beginning, but
Hold on. Okay, now watch when this guy disappears. Watch the little guy go walking by.
oh my God. Yeah, I
You
saw.
see?
Oh.
So yes, I do believe in it. And now right now I'm working with a gentleman in St. Augustine, which is the oldest city, very haunted property. He also had a thing in Savannah, another haunted city. So it looks like I may be working a new thing that just came into my lap in the last week or so. About possibly opening a destination for people that have gone on the ghost tour to come to a restaurant, a magic show in a restaurant, Butch's Ghost Bar and Magic Cafe, or Eddie's Magic, Ghost Bar and Magic Cafe, but something in the paranormal community, possibly.
And so you've never had an experience with paranormal, but you believe.
Yeah, I was in the house, and I would hear them, but I never saw one. Yeah, but I know so many people and mediums and paranormal people and the ghost tours, and so yes, I do believe in them. I just haven't had
So wait, you stayed in that house? You lived in that house?
yeah, I owned it for 3 years,
You
and
own the house and you live there and were you ever afraid?
no, I would challenge them. I would say, okay, it's just me by myself here, and this is a big house. It's a Victorian. Built in 1875 with a full basement
Wow.
and two full rooms of almost 1500 feet of room. So you had about 6,000 square feet, and it was a haunted house. It was built on a vortex, so there was always activity going on, and I would challenge them to come out and do something, and they never did.
Wow, that's crazy. Okay, so speaking of vortexes and paranormal activity, so I know that you're a sober gentleman, a sober man, and it's a subject close to my heart as a sober woman. So when did the partying, when did all of that start for you, the wild?
Well, earlier I spoke about going out of the country to do a movie back in 1969. And this is another, just this happenstance situation. I drove a friend of mine who was another actor to an interview up in Hollywood, a gentleman named Hall Bartlett, and he was married to Rhonda Fleming. the Miss Technicolor of the hair. And so he had a movie in Brazil, and I drove my friend up for the part. And as he came out of the reading, Hall spotted me and he goes, "Do you have a minute?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "May I speak to you?" And Rick sat down and I went in and I came out with Rick's part. He hired me. And 3 days later, I'm in Brazil, 16 years old. I had just turned 16.
Wow.
And this was the summer of 69. We had the moon landing. I turned 16 August 2nd, got my car. I was in love with a girl, and my first real serious relationship was happening. And Charlie Manson was running around Laurel Canyon where my girlfriend lived, all in this
Wow.
4 month window. And next, I go to Brazil for 3 months, and I'm just turned 16. I look about 14. And as my sister says at my meetings when I was picking up my first year of chips, she goes, "He left as Richie Cunningham and he came back as John Lennon." And that's where it started for me. Because when you're in a foreign country and you got money and all you got to do is show up for work in the morning and your free time is your free time, you can get into a lot of mischief.
So what kind of mischief did drugs and alcohol get you in, Butch?
Oh, just everything. It was bad. I mean, for a while it was fun. It was the 60s, and it was fun for a while. And I never did heroin. I never did needles, but pretty much everything else was on the table for a while. And then once I got to about 30, the 10 year run was like wearing thin, and it wasn't fun anymore. And money was gone, and now it's more maintenance and more self-medicating yourself. Back in the old days, it was a whole different world. You got a pound of weed, you gave away what you didn't, you sold enough to get even. You get 16 bags, you sell 10 of them, you got six for free, and you smoke it, you give it away. It was not a profit thing. It was not a
Right.
money. It was just getting your friends high and a social atmosphere. It changed a lot when it became a business and people started getting shot and killed. And I mean, when you see the movie Blow with Johnny Depp, that was pretty much me living in Manhattan Beach that time. That was the exact year we were on the,
Wow.
that was right where my stomping grounds were. And when you see the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Sunset Boulevard, that's my time. That was my world going from that time I was 16 to about 22. That was my world. And it's funny to see those movies because it's like, I know that street. I know that street. That's what I was doing. That's what I was doing. And I'm lucky I survived, to be honest with you, because I was in some wrong, bad places, doing some stupid stuff. But I'm a survivor, and then it led to a decade of speed and the coke and speed and pills. And I mean, we're quaaludes back in the day when nobody even knew what quaaludes were for, except just getting in trouble. And I kept somehow some I got in legal trouble. It's just all bad. But for some reason, God decided to keep me around for some reason, and I've
Did
now
you
got.
have did you have what was your bottom? Why'd you get sober?
What
What
happened
got you
was
sober?
my cousin got sober and my best friend got sober, and every once in a while, I knew that something had to change, but I was in denial. And every once in a while, right before you hit bottom, somebody would hire you and give you a whole bunch of money. And then it was like, oh, I got money again. So it was never like you're on a corner with a brown bag, but it was difficult to just admit it because every once in a while you'd get a perk, come your way. So my bottom was right after Halloween in 2010. I was on the East Coast, living in a very seedy part of town with a bunch of druggies, but I had this bag full of money, and I put together a big Halloween promotion that went sour. And my payoff, I had to pay off everybody. So instead of making money, I wound up spending all the money that I had saved up to pay off the failed Halloween party. But I paid it off. And right then, a friend of mine named Jody Ritson and John Rose, who I had met, came to me and said, "You need help. We found a place in California called the Oasis Treatment Center." And then a gentleman named Jim A, who was the original interventionist for A&E on the intervention
Wow.
film, he always wanted to get a Hollywood kid actor sober so they could help others. And I was the lucky recipient of his deal. And what happened was the only requirement was I just couldn't have been through any rehab centers like the merry-go-round that a lot of unfortunate people do. And I said, "No, I've never been in one." He goes, "Okay, you're qualified. So I flew out to LA, checked into Oasis Treatment Center on Ball 222 Ball Road next to Disneyland, listened up, and stayed in the system for about 3 years into sober living. And then I started getting back out and about, and just got the, got the burning bush. He called it a burning bush. He goes, once in a great while, a burning bush will happen. And he goes, then you got it. He goes, and so everything that was causing me to do what I was doing vanished. And I haven't had a desire. And I mean, I don't really do a lot of meetings anymore, but I do sponsor some people through social media to steer them into sobriety.
Fabulous.
Yeah. And I've never turned down a speaker meeting. I do speaker meetings and people ask me, but I'm not a real hardcore active meeting kind of guy. But whenever I go to California, I go to Oasis and pick up my chips. So for me, it works.
So, okay. I think the last time we talked, I don't think you really were going to meetings then. And I don't think you were sponsoring back then.
No.
So I think this is wonderful that you're doing that. So when you first came into program and you were in this treatment center and then you worked the steps, I assume, and you worked
Yes.
the program of recovery. So
do
you feel, is that part, because that's a huge part of my life every day, just it's ingrained, right? So that thinking of doing the right thing, being of service, gratitude.
Gratitude, right? Hit my knees every morning, every night, go to church. I mean, yeah, I'm a different person. I always felt I was a good person. I just had some really bad habits. And, I wasn't myself. The alcohol got a hold of me, and then the alcohol led to the drugs, and it's just a vicious, vicious circle. And, but it was interesting to go through treatment to hear other people's and learn so much from Jim, who was like 47 years sober, but you learn so much from the older guys. And I went in, I was 57 years old when I went into treatment. I was like one of the older guys. I was in a treatment center with a bunch of kids who were
right.
stealing Klonopins from their grandparents, and fentanyl and stuff. So it was a whole different world when I went in, but it's certainly not the same way that I was partying. The kids today, it's a whole different mindset. It's much scarier now.
Absolutely. And do you find that the isms that, because it's not just the drugs and alcohol for me, it's also, it can be food, it can be Facebook, it can be, I'm an addictive personality. I get caught up in all that stuff. So I have to be careful with a lot of things in my life. Do you find that's true for you?
No, I'm very, very, very lucky. And in fact, my sister, who was my biggest supporter when I went into the treatment, knows a lot of people who are issues actors and people in and out of the industry. And she says, you don't know how lucky you have it, because so many people are like one iota away from going to the bar. I mean, they're fighting it. It's there every day. And they're going, they're on their way to a meeting, or they're on their way to church. But she goes, you literally, something just was removed from you. You just, you still do the right thing, and you do the program and you're working it. But she goes, you don't have any triggers and you don't have any desires. She goes, you don't know how lucky you are. And I said,
I don't mean about drinking or using again. I just mean in other aspects of your life. You're not compulsive about things. You're not obsessive about other things.
I'm a little OCD. A couple things will, like, I will. If I'm in a market and I pick something up off the shelf, I have to put it back where I got it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple little things that I have to do. If I see something and I acknowledge that I should have picked it up and I don't, I got to go back and pick it up. There's just, what I do now is I just try to do the right thing. And like, if, you're walking along and you glance at something and you see something that needs to be addressed, instead of just waiting for the next person to do it, mm-hmm. I wind up doing it myself. And that's about the only weird little idiosyncrasy that I picked up is stuff that's got to go back. And I'm truthful. I have a real, real hard time telling any little yarns and stuff, sneaky behavior type stuff.
So you said that you sponsor people now online. Do you have?
Well, no,
do
I'm
you...
not, no, no, no. I don't. What I do is I don't sponsor people, because I'm really not in a position. I'm on the road so much.
Right.
And, I don't really believe in if you can't physically be there to be with these people, you can't really sponsor them. But what I do a lot of is I listen to people and I find people have come to shows, personal, almost everybody in the world knows somebody in their family that needs help. It's really, it's a pandemic. So what I've done a lot of is talking to people and getting them started and how to go after the first step and where do you go and how the system works and
That's
explain the
terrific.
process. That is what I've done, and I've done it very well, and I'm very, very proud that a couple of people have done extremely well and have thanked me. My son would be dead, thank God, thank you. And leaving Jim, when I first went in, he says, I've been open 22 years and I've reached 8,000 people. He goes, you get sober and you go on TV, you can reach a million people. And being leading by example is what I'm doing. And a lot of times the old days, it was Alcoholics Anonymous and you weren't supposed to admit what you're doing. So there was some of the old guys were a little resistant to being, public about it. And I get a little bit of heat occasionally from some of the old timers, but Jim said it's okay. And he's my grand sponsor. So if he says it's okay, and that's what I'm supposed to do, I have no problem doing it. And
Do
the neat.
you still speak to him? Do you still speak to your sponsor? Do you check in?
And the neat part about it is, and another thing is, what I really enjoyed is when you get sober, my biggest fear was, oh my God, what will I ever do? I'll never have fun anymore. Because my whole life was around bars. It was all about party. That was just what I did. And my biggest fear was I never would have any fun. And I'm having more fun now than I ever had. But the interesting thing is the sober teams out there, the successful, crazy rock stars, people. I mean, it's a cool club to be part of now.
Yes, it's a very cool. Does Giselle, is she a normie?
Yep, she's a normie, and it's like the and in the first couple of years, people you don't really get it, but once you hit double digits, even after 5 years, people were pretty much they would introduce themselves. You're in the program. You're a friend of Bill. Now, with Alice Cooper is a good example. Some of the big ass rock stars that I looked up to that were party animals in their day who are now sober. It's a very cool club to be part of.
Very cool club to be part
I
of.
know,
Yes.
and that's very exciting.
Very exciting. Butch, thank you so much for doing this. Thank you for being patient and coming back around when I was able to do it. And it's wonderful to see you as always. And I look forward to more you and good luck with everything that you're doing.
Thanks for thinking of me. I appreciate it. And let's do it again in a couple of years.
It sounds great, Butch. Take care.
Thank you so
Great to
much.
see you. Bye-bye.